Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you here again. This time it's Mr. Brian Keller to tell us all about his topic. Mr. Brian Keller, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you very much. I hope everyone can hear me okay. Thank you for coming to my session this afternoon. This is kind of a day of firsts for me. This is my first time to Belgium. This is the first time I presented in two countries in one day. I was in the Dev Days Netherlands event this morning. And this is my first time presenting in a movie theater. So this is kind of cool. I can even see myself up there. It's pretty neat. It's kind of trippy. All right. So who am I? Well, my name is Brian Keller. I work for Microsoft. I came here from Redmond. I've been at Microsoft for about 8 years. My first job at Microsoft was that of a J-Sharp product manager. So I'd like to think I've come up a few levels since then. I'm now the technical evangelist in charge of evangelizing Visual Studio application lifecycle management. So it's what we used to refer to as Visual Studio Team System. Every few years, the marketing team likes to keep us on our toes by changing the brand around. So now we are Application Lifecycle Management. So I work on Visual Studio, of course. I also have a show every week on Channel 9 called This Week on Channel 9. I do a lot of podcasts on Channel 9. So if you're looking for interesting content, that's definitely something I would recommend. We'd love to have you as a viewer. I also blog on MSDN, so write down that address, blogs.msdn.com/BrianKell. The reason I mention this is that everything that I'm going to do today is actually available within a virtual hard drive that you can download if you go to my blog and look at one of my recent posts. So before I got on a plane to come here, I made sure that everything I'm doing is available for you to download and check out. I also have 9 hands-on labs that I've put together that you can use to check out all the demos that I'm doing and more as well. So it's about 10 hours of content if you're interested in some of this material. I'll also make my slides available via my blog as well. I recently completed my first book, co-authored with a few other great guys that are out in the community as well. And so this is a book that comes out in the next couple of weeks. It basically covers everything across application lifecycle management, including software testing, setting up Team Foundation Server, the architecture tools, some of the development tools like the static analysis and profiling capabilities. So it's about 800 pages, and I would recommend it if you're interested in this topic, or another one of the great books that's out there as well. I don't really make any money off the book, but just want to make you aware of it in case it's something that that interests you. So I'm going to be spending a lot of my time doing demonstrations. So I hope you don't mind that I'm going to dip out of PowerPoint here for a while. And one of the things that I'll be talking about, of course, is Team Foundation Server. I'll be talking a lot about the architecture tools that we have coming, some of the new project management capabilities of Team Foundation Server, some of the new development capabilities. And then software testing is an area that's so big for this release that I've actually deferred that until another session that I have tomorrow at the same time. It's tomorrow at 4:15. I'm not sure of the room, but we'll be spending 75 minutes talking specifically about software testing. And those 5 areas are really the main areas that make up application lifecycle management for us in this release. So I hope that everyone here, regardless of your role, finds something that's interesting, something that's worthwhile, something you can take back to your teams, so that even when I'm showing the architecture tools, if that's not something that interests you, hopefully you can take that back and point some of your colleagues to the virtual hard drive and have them go through the hands-on labs or watch this video once it's available on Channel 9 to find out how, really, at the end of the day, you can work better together as a team. Because really, that's our mission back at Microsoft, is to help you collaborate better so you can build better software. So I mentioned Team Foundation Server. Team Foundation Server is kind of the heart of our application lifecycle management strategy. Has anyone personally installed Team Foundation Server 2005 or 2008? Okay, we see a couple up there. I am so sorry. I apologize to those of you who raised your hands, because it was not an easy thing to do. And trust me, I know that I have the receding hairline to prove it. I've installed it a lot of times. But in this release, in Team Foundation Server 2010, we've done a lot of work to help you get up and running with Team Foundation Server very, very quickly and make it a seamless installation. And what I was thinking we would do is go ahead and install Team Foundation Server 2010 as part of my talk. But I've installed it 1,000 times, so I would love to have someone from the audience volunteer to come down and actually install it for us. Someone, preferably, that's never even installed Team Foundation Server before. Do we have any volunteers out there? Awesome. Sounds good. Come on down, please. Big round of applause for our volunteer. I'm always nervous when I ask because sometimes no one raises their hands and I have to pick on a volunteer. So thank you very much for coming on down. I promise it will be painless. And what is your name?
Steen.
Steen? Brian. And we've never met before, right? This isn't rehearsed. You've never installed TFS before. Okay. So what I'm going to ask you to do is step right up and go ahead and install Team Foundation Server. I'm not going to give you a lot of instructions. So he's clicking right on through. You didn't even read that license agreement. Man, you never do. That's how we get you, you know. So he's figuring out which components he wants to install. Great. Awesome. And so during this phase of setup, what you've done is you've decided which components you want to install, and you're starting to copy those onto the machine. And so what you may notice here is that we're actually installing Team Foundation Server on Windows 7. We support a new configuration called Team Foundation Server Basic. Team Foundation Server Basic allows you to install source control, work item tracking, and build without having to have a server operating system. Now, if you do want to take advantage of SharePoint integration or the reporting services offered by Team Foundation Server, you will have to step up to Windows Server, but you can install everything that we're going to do today on the basic install using Windows Vista or Windows 7. The other thing I'll point out is for those of you who have Visual Studio 2010 or will be getting Visual Studio 2010 with an MSDN subscription, we're actually giving you the client access license and a server license in your MSDN subscription. So if you have 30 people on your team that have MSDN subscriptions, then that means you have 30 servers. Everyone can have their own Team Foundation Server if you want, or you can just set up one for your team to share. So you've finished the first phase, and we'll go ahead and configure this. At this point, it's going to give you an option to figure out which one of the wizards you want to go through. So if you're upgrading from 2005 or 2008, this is where you would select the upgrade template. We'll actually just be doing the basic template today. You'll notice that you can use SQL Server Express in the next step here. Now he's reading. So we're going to use the existing SQL Server Express instance. So all I've done to prep this box is install SQL Server Express and configure IIS. We also have the .NET Framework 4 installed as well. Good? Yep. That looks good to me. It's a tough job, huh? Next. And so now what it's doing is it's actually running a system check to make sure that everything's configured properly. For those of you that installed TFS 2005 and 2008, you know that you can kind of get two-thirds of the way down the installation path and then realize you're missing a prerequisite or something's not set up correctly. So at this point, it's going to do a bunch of configuration work. This will take another 5 minutes or so, and we'll go ahead and check back on it later. But thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on down and being a brave volunteer. Once again, round of applause. Thank you. So like I said, I wasn't sure if we'd actually get a volunteer, so I have another virtual machine that's already configured and ready to go with Team Foundation Server. So let's go ahead and dive right in. For my demonstrations, I'm going to be focused on a sample application called Tailspin Toys. Tailspin Toys is a fictional e-commerce website. We sell model airplanes, so nothing complicated here. It's based on ASP.NET MVC2. So I'll go ahead and close out of that. And what I'll do is I'll open up Visual Studio. And one of the things that that you may want to do when you're first starting off a project is you may have inherited an existing code base. Or maybe this is a code base that you need to go make changes to, and you haven't looked at it for 6 or 12 months. And so you want to understand exactly what's going on within the code base before you start making changes and refactoring and adding new capabilities. Now, I know everyone in this room probably has really great up-to-the-minute documentation, but bear with me. Hypothetically, let's pretend that you don't. What would you do to actually start understanding your code base? And so in 2010, we've done a lot of work to help you reverse engineer your existing .NET solutions and help understand things like dependencies that exist across classes, across assemblies, and so on. So what I'll do is I'll generate a new dependency graph. I can generate a custom graph if I want to and decide exactly which types and namespaces I'm interested in. Maybe I'm interested in having all of my public types actually show up and all of my public methods so that I can share that with someone who might be consuming a library that I'm putting together. But for this demo, I'll just show you what it looks like when you generate a dependency graph by assembly. So now what this is doing is it's reverse engineering my solution. Down here at the bottom, in a second, you'll see it start to crank away. and it's already found 10,307 links and 2,880 nodes. And so this is a dependency graph. It's based on DGML. DGML, of course, is a modeling standard that we can then use with other modeling tools as well. So we could export this, and we could operate on it with other tools that also support DGML. But at face value here, you can see that we have all of our different assemblies. You can see that there are references between one and another. The strength of the line indicates exactly the strength of the dependencies. So if there's a lot of dependencies between one component and another, then you'll have a very thick line, and if not, you'll have a thin line. I can, for example, expand generics here, start to drill in, and understand, let's take a look at this I collection, understand which other components it relates to within my solution. I don't have to scroll, I can just click on the arrow and it takes me straight to the other component that it's dependent on. But what I'll do is I'll go ahead and collapse everything and go back to the original view. And let's take a look at externals down here. So if I expand externals, you can see that externals actually includes things like the .NET framework. So these are things that are not within my solution. These are external dependencies that I have to be aware of. And so these are important as well, because it's nice to know which external libraries I'm depending on. Maybe I depend on having a certain version of the .NET framework installed on the machine. And so as I start to drill through here, I can see there's things like MS CoreLib. Well, maybe MS CoreLib is not something that I want to represent in my diagram. Everything uses MS CoreLib. So let's just go ahead and delete it from the diagram. Of course, we're not deleting it from my system. There's two versions here that that we're referencing, so that's good to know. I think we also have a system.dll. We don't need that in the diagram. So you can see you can start to prune the diagram to really serve the needs of what you might be interested in. But one thing you may notice here is that these lines that are drawing dependencies on externals, they actually stop at the boundary for my externals. And so that's by design. So by default, we're not going to give you lots of crisscrossing dependencies and really clutter your diagram. But let's say that I really do want to understand the individual dependencies that exist within those assemblies that are referred to as external. That's no problem. I can actually just right-click over here and remove that group. And now it's going to take all those external assemblies and mash those in with the rest of my project as well. But I just lost a level of detail. Now I don't know which one of those assemblies are external. So that's not a problem. I can come over to my legend. I can add a new node property. You can see I have several to choose from over here. And what I'll do is I'll select the isExternal node property. So that becomes a new item on my legend. Select the dropdown, background color. We'll make that red. And now all of my externals light up as red, and then here are my original solution items. Another thing that this is useful for is understanding analysis between circular references or hubs that exist within my project. So I could run that analysis against my project and start to do things like determine if there's any unused code in my project. Maybe it's time for me to refactor and remove some of the code that's not being referenced so that my project becomes less complex. So that's the dependency validation or the dependency graphs that you can start to put together. Another one of the new architect capabilities is the ability to actually drill into my project using the Architecture Explorer. And I can drill into the project by either class or solution view. So I'll show you what that looks like for a class view. What I can do is start moving my model from left to right and drill further and further down into my project. And so you can see I have this namespace tailspin.admin.app. That has several types in it. So product relationship, maybe I'm interested in that. That has several members. So product is interesting. And then that has two methods, get product and set product. And so at this point, I've kind of hit the end of my tree, but what if I'm interested in not things that get product calls, but instead, let's make it a little recursive here, anything that actually calls get product, so we'll say all inbound. And so at this point, you can start to see that product then calls get product, and so this can become kind of recursive, but it's a nice way of actually going back and forth and understanding exactly how one method or one type may relate to another. I can then generate a dependency graph from here, or generate a call graph from here to show exactly how tailspin.admin.app eventually relates down to get product. And I can take set product and move that up onto the graph as well. And so just another nice way of helping to understand what's in my solution. So this is DGML. Once again, I could use this with other modeling tools. I could print this to XPS or PDF, share this with the rest of my team, and there's my documentation, and it can help me keep up to date and inform the rest of the team members of exactly what's going on. Another really cool architecture capability that we've added into Visual Studio 2010 now is the support for UML diagrams. So previously, you may have had to use a tool like Visio outside of Visual Studio to support UML diagrams. Now you can do that all that from right within the tool. And so we support 5 UML 2.1.1 compliant diagrams. So we have, for example, the use case diagram. We support the activity diagram, use case diagram, class diagram, sequence diagram, and component diagram. And so this is more than just a diagram, though. I mean, it'd be one thing just to give you a diagram. We know you can do that in MS Paint or on the whiteboard. This actually has a full UML model explorer behind this. So as I start to put UML elements in here, then the relationship between one component, maybe in the use case diagram, can actually relate to another component that might be in an activity diagram, for example. Another thing that I can do is leverage the capability of Team Foundation Server to then, for example, create a work item from here. So maybe I want to put together my use case diagram and then create a task, assign that to a developer, and say that you need to go implement this task. And then when the developer opens up the task, they don't just see a one-line description saying what they need to do. They can then go back to the UML diagram and understand how their work relates with the overall system and how that's supposed to flow together with the rest of the solution. We support sequence diagrams as well, and one of the cool things about the sequence diagram is that you can actually reverse engineer a sequence diagram from existing code. So let's say that my development lead comes to me and says that she wants me to add some existing functionality to the way that remove item works. And so I come into my cart controller, and I look at remove item, and maybe this is something that... There's remove item. Maybe this is something that I didn't work on, so I don't really understand how remove item works. Well, what might you do? Well, you might F5 the application. You start setting some breakpoints. You start going to reference. You start looking at all the different places across your project to try and get a sense for how this works, and you might actually end up drawing out your own sequence diagram type of artifact to understand how this is implemented. Well, now what you can do is you can just right-click, generate a sequence diagram. This is asking me basically how deep do I want to go with respect to understanding the way that this relates to other parts of my project. We'll click on OK. And this is going to, once again, reverse engineer your .NET code into a sequence diagram. So there you see the nice sequence diagram. At this point, if I wanted to propose some changes to the way that the sequence diagram worked, I could open up the UML toolbox, drag and drop some additional layers onto here, and then save that out and once again link that back to a work item. Now, my favorite part of the new architecture tools that we're doing is something called the layer diagram. Now, we're all familiar with layer diagrams. We've drawn them thousands of times on whiteboards. A layer diagram basically looks like this, where you say, okay, we've got this ASP.NET MVC application, so we're going to have our model, our view, our controller, and then you draw that on the whiteboard, or maybe you represent that in Visio, and you ship that around to the team, and you say, okay, we need to make sure that any calls to the presentation layer actually go through the controller logic, and then eventually impact the model, and so on. And so you want to make sure that you, of course, don't go the other way around. And you define your business logic and you send that out to the team. But what happens? Well, the team gets that diagram, they hang it up on their wall, and eventually your project starts to go out of date because people start doing things that don't conform to the diagram. And it's really, really hard to get your team to actually not only understand the architecture that you lay out, but also in their day-to-day practices, make sure that they're not violating the layer diagram or other constraints that you put forward. So what we allow you to do is, beyond the diagram, we allow you to start defining, for example, which classes are actually supposed to be modeled in each part of this layer diagram. And so you can see here that within MVC, we have these 3 different classes. So these are different controllers. We can start to represent links, so relationships, to say that controllers is allowed to call into model, but model is not allowed to call into controllers because this is a one-way relationship because we're pointing pointing one direction and the arrow doesn't point back the other direction. So that's not rocket science. But then what we allow you to do is actually use this diagram to validate your solution. So I'll go ahead and validate this solution. Once again, it's going to reverse engineer. It's going to check out all my existing dependencies, and it's going to tell me whether or not my solution is actually compliant based on the layer diagram that I've put together. And so what this is doing is it's coming back and telling me, actually, your layer diagram and your project don't match up, or rather your solution don't match up. And so you can see I have a number of errors down here, and it's telling me which components call into other components which are disallowed by the layer diagram. If I double click on one of these, it'll actually take me straight to the lines of code which are in violation of this. Now, maybe in reality, I actually put the layer diagram together incorrectly. Maybe, you know, I put all the classes in the right place, but I might be missing a relationship that we actually do want to allow. And so the other thing I can do is I can right-click and I can say generate dependencies. And this is going to do the reverse. This is going to go back and say, okay, let's actually update the layer diagram to match what's in the solution. And so here you can see that we have two bidirectional dependencies which were added. And so for those of you that were paying close attention, you may have seen that these links change from one-directional links to bidirectional links. And so now this is the layer diagram which represents my project. And if I was to then validate this again, then everything would pass. So we know that everything passes at this point. How do we make sure that our developers don't actually stray from the layer diagram that we've put together? Well, there's a few things you can do with this diagram. One thing that you can do is you can actually validate it at build time when the developers are building their solutions. So you can make this just another check, just like static analysis, so that they get a warning or even an error when they try to build a solution that may not conform to the layer diagram. The other thing that you can do is you can hook this up to your team build so that you validate it anytime someone checks code into Team Foundation server. And so as you'll see me demonstrate later on, we have a new capability called gated check-in where this plays really nicely because you can basically prevent anyone from ever breaking the build. And when coupled with this capability, you can prevent them from ever validating or invalidating the layer diagram that you've put together. So I'll show you how that works later on. So at this point, let's say that I understand my project, I'm starting to get to the point that I'm ready to do some work, and I'm ready to actually take some items off the backlog and plan an iteration. Well, one of the things that we've done in Team Foundation Server 2010 is we've done a lot of work to enable what's referred to as hierarchical work item support. And so hierarchical work item relationships allow you to take, for example, a use case or a user story or a requirement, whatever you use to actually track the capabilities that you're going to deliver as value back to your customer. And then you can start to link things like child subtasks. So how are we actually going to enable that work to happen? Or another type of relationship we can represent now is the tests and tested by. And so as you'll see in my talk tomorrow, we have test cases represented as first case work items now. And you can then link those test cases back to the individual requirements that they back up. Finally, you have successor and predecessor, and there's other relationship types as well. You can even define your own. But those are the three main types of relationship types that really help us light up additional reporting capabilities so that I can start at the highest level from the stakeholder level and say, I really care about this feature. Number one, when is it going to be done? And number two, how's the quality standing up? How's my testing effort coming along? So I'll show you some demonstrations of how we actually back that up. Another interesting thing to note is that Windows 7 and Office 2010 were built using an early version of Team Foundation Server 2010. So all of the features for Windows 7 were actually tracked within Team Foundation Server, and the way that they actually implemented those features was to track all that work so that someone like Steven Sanofsky, who's in charge of Windows now, he could look across his entire project and say, when is this feature going to be done? When is jump list going to be finished? And so he could then look at the individual tasks that make that up and look at the testing effort and understand exactly how that's all linked together. So let's go ahead and show you what that looks like within Team Explorer. And so Team Explorer, of course, is the interface for working with Team Foundation Server. First thing I'll do is I'll take a look at my product planning query. And so here, this is just a flat list of the various work items that that we want to implement for the customer. And so if any of you work in an agile fashion or a scrum fashion, you're probably familiar with the concept of a backlog, and you start to stack rank all the different work items that your customer has asked for, and then you assign a rough order of magnitude estimation for how much work you think it's going to do to take to implement, and then you just go down the list iteration by iteration, popping those off and completing the work. And so that's what we're going to be doing here. What we've done to facilitate that is we've put together a number of agile planning workbooks. And so I have an agile planning workbook that helps me manage the backlog. So we'll open that up. Of course, you don't have to use Excel for this. I'll show you how you can do similar things within Visual Studio. But Excel happens to be a really nice tool for working with this. So I'll just refresh this page, make sure we have the latest data. And if we move over to the iteration column, you can see that there's some work that was done within iteration one. Maybe we're in the middle of doing some work for iteration two, and now I want to look ahead and start planning out iteration three. And so if we take a look at the next spreadsheet, or the next worksheet in here, you can see that I've already represented iteration one. We've done a bunch of work. Iteration two, we're in the middle of doing some work, and now I want to plan iteration three. And I think Monday through Friday next week is going to be the 5th through the 9th. That's right. So let's represent that. And let's say we have a team size of 3. And so that's 5 days. Now, at this point, we would do what's called a yesterday's weather analysis. And so we would say, how much work did we do in iteration two when we had a team size of 3? And so at this point, it looks like we were able to bite off 11 story points, and we've already delivered on 3, so we think that we're on track to deliver a total of 14 story points during that iteration. So let's take the same amount of work for iteration 3. And so we can come back to my product backlog. And we can say, okay, let's just start assigning items to iteration 3. So we'll assign a few, and then we'll check and see where we're at. And so it looks like we still have a little bit more work we could take on, maybe an additional 4 story points. So let's come back to my backlog. And if we look at the number of story points we have, this one's 9. That's too big. 7's too big. But here's 4. So let's take this one. And check my graph again. And so that looks like the right amount of work. So we won't know for sure until we start breaking down this work and assigning it to the individual team members. We'll do that in the next step. But at this point, this seems like a good starting point. So let's go ahead and take this data, and we'll push it back to Team Foundation Server, and then we'll actually start planning this individual sprint. So if I come back to Team Foundation Server and I take a look at iteration 3, we have this iteration 3 backlog. So let's open up iteration 3. It's going to give me a similar view, but this is going to be scoped specifically for this individual iteration. So this is how we'll actually start to answer the question of how much work is assigned to an individual, what type of work is assigned to those people, and so on. So the first thing you'll notice here is that we actually have the hierarchy represented. So you can see that the first level of detail here is actually the user story. So as a store administrator, I should be able to track rebates or whatever the functionality you're going to deliver. And then the next level below that, as it's indented here, you can see that we have the individual tasks that we think we're going to need to implement in order to make that user story a reality. So I've already broken down the first 3 tasks. We also have this new task down here, which probably needs to be broken down as well. So let's go ahead and add some children to it. And you can see that the way we represent parent-child within the spreadsheet is just by using different columns. So if I wanted to have a title 3 column, I could do that, and then that would be a grandchild, for example. I'll save you from my terrible typing skills and do some copy and paste magic. Okay, so those are 3 new tasks. I've already assigned them to 3 people based on who I think can do the work. They're already sized, so we have 2, 3, 6 That could be days, that could be hours, or it's really kind of up to you to define. They're already assigned to iteration 3. Let's go ahead and assign the rest of this work to iteration 3 as well. And now we'll come back and do the same thing we did in the last spreadsheet, which is to say, when is this iteration going to last? So that's 5 days. Now if I come to capacity, I can say which team members are working on this iteration. And I think realistically, they'll probably, you know, with interruptions and everything, they'll probably be able to work for 5 hours a day. And then you can start to see an immediate breakdown showing exactly how much work is assigned to an individual, as well as how much work is assigned to a team. And so here, my team capacity, that looks pretty good. It looks like, you know, even if we have some unforeseen things come up, that's not going to be a problem. But if you take a look at April here, she's kind of at her limits. So she might say to Abu, you know, hey, is there any work that you might be able to take on? And Abu says, sure. He's a helpful guy like that. So he's going to take a look at the work that's currently assigned to April, and he's going to say, well, this one, you know, this one's a pretty big story point. This is eight units of work. I might be able to take that on, so we'll go ahead and pop that onto Abu. And so now it looks like everyone's pretty well within what they can take on. So, of course, now April's feeling like, you know, next week's Easter, so I would love to take Monday and Tuesday off. So she may come to us and say, you know, April is going to take an extended Easter weekend, and that's the 5th and the 6th, so that's 2 days. And of course, as we think about this, maybe the rest of the team wants to take a day off for Easter as well, so they deserve that. And that will be on the 5th. And if we come back to capacity, now it looks like April's actually overloaded. So what we'll do is we'll come back to the iteration backlog and say, you know, we were feeling like we could take on this extra unit of work over here, but really that was probably unrealistic for a 4-day week. So let's push that back to the backlog and take a look at our capacity. Now that looks good. So I'm pretty comfortable with that. And so the idea with what I'm showing you here is that it's really easy to quickly and in a very agile manner start to plan your work, start to understand who the work is assigned to, make sure you're not overloading your team members, take into account interruptions that happen. The other really nice thing about this being based on Excel is that you can come in here and you can modify the formulas to your heart's content. So I've seen teams within Microsoft who have done things like, let's take into account the number of bugs that are currently assigned to a developer. It's not fair to give them all this new work to implement and expect that they're not going to have time to go back and fix bugs that may have come up in previous iterations. So you can start to pull in that data from TFS or make an approximation that says that, you know, after a busy iteration, we need to then allocate 30% of our time to fixing bugs during the next iteration, anything you want along those lines. The other thing that you might want to do with this is you might want to start to represent skill sets as well. So maybe Abu is really good at ASP.NET development, but isn't really great at writing stored procedures. And so maybe you want to represent the skills so that you can start to allocate which work gets assigned to which individual. So again, we've given you a kind of a workbook. Think of that as a starting point, and then you can take that and then build upon it and make your teams more productive. So now that work has been saved in Excel, it's been pushed back to Team Foundation Server. Let's take a look at doing some similar things within Visual Studio. I can open up a query now, and you'll see that within Visual Studio, we also support the same level of work item hierarchy. So you can see I've got, you know, the same kind of indention between user stories and tasks. I can even do some things like that you may not expect, like being able to drag and drop some of these work items around, being able to indent them. I can right-click. I can say create a new linked work item, and then that says what kind of relationship do you want to represent. Maybe it's a successor, predecessor thing. Maybe it's a test, tested by thing. The other nice thing about this is that, you know, I didn't really mean to make those changes, and you may notice that those are bolded. So if I hit refresh now, then it's going to ask me if I want to save those changes, and of course I don't. So I understand a lot of you may also like to use Project Server to put together Gantt charts and understand exactly when work is going to happen. So we support Project Server as well. Let's go ahead and open the same work within Project. I'm sorry, I misspoke. We don't support Project Server yet. Project Server is something we're working on. We support the Project Clients right now, and then we'll be delivering Project Server in the future. So what you can see here is that we have the parent-child relationship represented within project. We can also come in here and define a successor predecessor. So maybe I realized that, you know, it would be really nice if we actually designed the website before we implemented the website. So let's go ahead and do that. So we'll say that implementing the website has a dependency on number 4. And so you can see that that's represented over here on the right-hand side within my chart. And now you could do some of this with TFS 2005 and 2008. The problem with that is that you had to then maintain this separate project plan off to the side, because in TFS 2005 and 2008, of course, we didn't understand all the relationship types that project did. And so you had to have this disparate data set of data sources. Well, now what I can do is I can just publish all this data back to Team Foundation Server. It's going to keep track of the successor and predecessor relationships, and we don't have to worry about maintaining a separate project plan. We can always regenerate this if we want to. And so if I take a look, for example, at work item number 33 now, back within Visual Studio, and if I take a look at the links, we now have that predecessor relationship represented. So that's just a quick demonstration of some of those capabilities. Now, the other thing that we really wanted to help you do in this release was understand the data that exists within the system better. And the way that we've helped you in the past is by shipping a bunch of reports to help you do that. So Team Foundation Server was built from the ground up to integrate work item tracking and source control and builds. And then we bring all that together with a number of reports that can help you really understand which direction your projects are headed, what kind of impediments you have, what kind of trajectory you have. Are you on track to meet your deadlines if you communicated to the customer? The challenge with what we had in 2005 and 2008 was that we didn't make it really easy for you to create your own reports. So in the event that you did something like customize a process template and change the workflow for the work items, we kind of didn't really help you update those reports. And so even internally within Microsoft, the reports that we build and ship with Team Foundation Server, people who do this full time, that takes them about a week to put together one of these reports. And so in 2010, we've dramatically lowered the bar for putting together these types of reports based on TFS. And the first way that we've done that is we've enabled you to do what's called report from query. So let me just put together a new query. And I'll say, I would love to have a report showing the work that's assigned to people on my team. And so Team Foundation Server doesn't understand the concept of an organizational team. So, you know, there might be 30 different people that access this Team Foundation Server, but I'm a manager and I'm interested in exactly who's on my team. So let's say that we've got 3 people on our team, Abu, April, and Doris. Let me just group this clause here. And if I run this query, I get back a list of work items, so no surprise there. And so queries are really easy for us to work with as developers. We use queries all the time, right? But then turning this into an actual report based on analysis services like you've had to do in the past, you'd have to learn MDX, and it's just really messy. Well, now what I can do is I can take this data, I can open it up in Excel, and I can actually say create report in Microsoft Excel. And so what this does, you can see it's translating my work item query. So it's looking at what were the types of things that I was pulling together, and it's going to come back with a number of suggested reports for me. So I'll select all the reports. We'll say finish. In just a few seconds here, it's going to give us 6 different reports in this case that can show us everything from current snapshots of the current work that's assigned to me, and also trends as well. So how has this query changed over time? So here I can see work item type, how much work is assigned to these people, who is this work assigned to, what's the state of this work. You can start to see trends in here, who's it assigned to, and so on and so forth. Now let's say that you also wanted to add another filter on this to understand which area path it's assigned to. And so if you're not familiar with area paths are a capability of TFS that allows you to segregate your work item, usually by feature. So you might have stuff that's assigned to the website and stuff that's assigned to the admin console. Or you can also separate it by functional area, stuff that's assigned to the database, stuff that's assigned to the website, for example. And in the past, the schema for the database warehouse was actually very difficult. Well, we've done a lot of work to actually clean that up and make it easy for you to understand which fields are which. And so I could just come down to the work item, and there's area path. We'll go ahead and check that box. And so now you can see that this has actually expanded to say not only work item count by state, but by state and by area that's assigned to. So we can see database and business logic and website. And so that might be something that I want to make available to my team. And so what I could do if I wanted to, I don't have it set up on this machine, but I could come into publish, and I could publish that out somewhere like Excel services. And so that you can have a really nice Moss dashboard that has all the information that I'm interested in. So maybe as a team lead, I want to come in the morning and see all the information that relates to my my particular team. I can either do that in Excel, or I can publish that out to Moss. So while we're at it, let's go ahead and check out the TFS Basic. It looks like TFS Basic is all set up, so that's great. One of the things that you'll notice in here is that we actually give you an administration console as well. So a lot of the things that you would have had to do in the past from the command line have actually been rolled up into this administration console. And so you can start to you know, change passwords and administer security straight from within the administration console. We also introduce a new concept within TFS, and I'm mostly speaking to the TFS administrators in the room, but this is a new concept called Team Project Collections. So team project collections give you a unit of isolation around one or more team projects. And that's really nice, because if you've looked at the TFS 2005 and 2008 databases, when you start creating team projects, those all get layered and interspersed across multiple databases within SQL Server. And so now what you can do is you can have a single team project collection, which gets entirely housed within one database, and then you can back up and restore that database independent of other team project collections that you might have as well. You can also move that team project collection between one TFS server and another. So let's say that you have a TFS server that has 30 projects on it, and you find that one particular project is just growing and growing and growing. It has a lot of people on it. You want to move that to another Team Foundation server instance. All you do is you come into this console, detach the team project collection, move that database to another machine, and then reattach it. So that actually lends itself to a number of different configurations. If we take a look at some of those configurations, of course, this is your basic configuration where everything's configured on one server. That's what I have set up on my laptop right now. That's what TFS 2005 and 2008 support. We also, in the past, supported the ability to separate that and move it across multiple machines using one server for your application tier, one server for your database tier. You could also cluster those together. And then if you get really fancy and you have a pretty big team, you can start setting up multiple application tiers, put a network load balancer in front of that, and then even if you have to take down an application tier or one of them crashes for whatever reason, then you'll have some redundancy in there. You also have load balancing as well. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the enhanced TFS management and all the different components that make that up, but I really just wanted to make people aware of that. And of course, we also support the ability to put all the different components of TFS across multiple machines. So if you want to take advantage of our SharePoint integration, you can put that on a different SharePoint farm, maybe one that's already existing. If you have a different server for your builds, you can do that. And really, we want to give you as much flexibility as you need there. Speaking of SharePoint, if I open up my team project portal, we support integration with WSS. So when you create a new project, we actually give you a project portal where we start to house all of your reports, any SharePoint documents like those Excel workbooks that I was working with. Those are actually housed within SharePoint for you. We also support Moss as well. So I don't have Moss on this machine, but if you do install Moss, I'll show you some screenshots of what the light up experience looks like for Moss. It's really, really nice. So WSS is kind of the basic installation where you get what you're looking at here, and then if you want to start lighting up additional dashboards and take advantage of Excel services to store those custom reports, I definitely recommend checking out Moss as well. So this is taking a little while to load up just because it's warming up. But you can see here, straight from my dashboard, I can start to see my burn down, my burn rate. I can start to see a list of all the work items that exist within my system. So that's my product backlog. In the past, we had a separate power tool called Team System Web Access that you could install. And Team System Web Access gives you a nice way to access your work items, or even a read-only version of your source control, or look at all your builds via another web interface, so you don't even have to have Visual Studio installed on the machine. You may have also seen that we purchased a company called TeamPrize back in October. TeamPrize, for the past few years, has been delivering a really great J2SE-based client for connecting back to Team Foundation Server. They also integrate that client with Eclipse, so straight from within Eclipse, you can do, I'd say, 95% of what you'll see me do within Visual Studio in terms of working with your source control and your work items. So we really want to provide you with this heterogeneous solution for completing all of your work here. So here within Team System Web Access, I'll just show you quickly a couple of features here. We have work items. I can open up my team queries, take a look at my backlog. We support the same level of hierarchy in here, so you can see I don't even need Visual Studio or Excel installed. All I have to do is hit this portal, and we work in Internet Explorer and Firefox and all the browsers that you would expect. Let me show you quickly some of the reports that we have. I have a lot of reports in my slide deck. I'm not going to take you through all of them. The purpose of having them in my slide deck, though, is so that they're available for you after the conference if you want to go back and look at these in greater detail. But this is one of my favorite reports that lights up in 2010. The nice thing about this is that you can see, first, we're looking at a view across my user stories. So again, coming back to the business level, what does the customer actually care about? What does the CIO who's writing our checks actually care about? Well, this is a view that shows them which user stories we're currently working on. So moving across to the next column, you can see the amount of work that I've completed. So you can see when something's on track to being done. And then we can also see the test plan at a glance as well. So you can see green is good. So green's passing tests, red's failing tests, and then there's also some other tests that haven't been run. Maybe those tests haven't been written yet. Maybe they just haven't been executed yet. We don't know yet, but we have other reports we can use to drill into that as well. This is a glance at what you get when you upgrade to Moss and are working with Moss in conjunction with Team Foundation Server, so you can start to see a bunch of different reports over here. The other thing that you'll notice is that on the left-hand side, might be kind of hard to read, but you have burn down, quality, bugs, tests. These are all different perspectives, different views into your project that you might want to pivot on so you can understand, are things on track to be completed? Are things on track to be completed well with high quality? And are we on track to close out all the bugs and so on? Code coverage, code churn. Like I said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I just want to quickly make you aware of some of the reports that we ship. So these are all out-of-the-box reports. You don't have to build any of these reports yourself. This shows build success over time. So Team Foundation Server provides a free build server that it ships with. And so if you wanted to set up your own build environment, you could do that. And then we aggregate all the data that's coming in across work that's being completed, across tests that are being executed, and we can start to push that data back to the builds. And so I'll just maybe mention a really good best practice to think about. I'll be talking later about continuous integration and the idea of building early and building often. That's something I'm hoping that most people in this room are familiar with already. But one of the things you want to think about is you probably also have a nightly build as well. And so when you start thinking about reporting, you probably want to hinge your reports off of a nightly or a daily build, and then use the continuous integration builds as a way to pull together a quick status to say whether or not something, a change you just made, broke the build. And the reason you want to have the two different builds is that if you use your continuous integration to look at this, it's going to be much higher granularity than what you want. It's going to be too many boxes. It's going to be too hard for you to see exactly what's going on over time, day to day. So just think about having different build definitions if you want to get this kind of data. Here's another look at that. you know, again, burn down charts. Reactivation rates, basically, are we assigning bugs to developers and then they're saying that they're fixed and then the testers go back and look at the bugs and they're not actually fixed? Well, that could indicate that either the developers aren't doing a good job of fixing the bugs, or it could indicate that the testers are not doing a good job of communicating to the developers exactly what the bugs are. But at least this is a way that we can take a look and understand, all right, maybe this is a conversation we need to go have with the development and the testing team to understand what we might need to fix moving forward. And again, I'll show you a lot more about software testing tomorrow. Remaining work, status of iterations, and so on. So here's another graph that shows the number of test cases, how many have been implemented, how many are still in design. So you can see lots and lots of data in here. So for my next, what I want to show you next, I'm going to talk about branching and merging visualization changes that we have in Team Foundation Server. So I'm sure everyone in here probably works on some sort of branch structure of varying complexity. And of course, we branch for isolation. We branch to preserve old releases that we want to track and understand what went to a customer on a given date. There's lots of reasons that we might branch. But if I take a look at a simple branching scenario, let's say that the marketing team comes to me and says, you know what, we've got our website here, we're selling lots of planes, that's great, but we're getting a lot of calls from customers because these links at the bottom don't actually work. And sure enough, if I try to click on those links, I see that they just take me back to the same page, and so that's a problem. You know, we're getting a lot of calls from customers saying, why doesn't your website work? Actually, they probably can't call us because they can't actually click on these buttons and get our phone number, but you get the point, right? So this is something that, you know, we want to fix, but the marketing team is right to complain that we need this fixed yesterday. We can't wait for the next release of this website that the development team's currently working on. Maybe that's slated for next Friday. So instead, what we want to do is say, this is important enough that this is a change we're going to fast track into production. And so we have a few branches in my source control tree. You can see that I have iteration 1 and iteration 2, and main is another branch. And we have this release node down here that has another branch called production. And so, okay, well, production seems like that's a good place to start. Maybe I'm not super familiar with this branching structure. You can imagine, you know, your own branching structure might have dozens or even hundreds of branches. And so where do I get started? Well, if I take a look at production and I come down into this solution, I happen to know that those links are actually stored in a file called template.master, which is inherited across my project. So if I open up template.master and I scroll down, we're going to make a very complex code change, and that is we're going to comment out these lines. So we'll comment that out. Go ahead and save that. So that's the change that we're fast tracking to production. And I'm going to give it a comment. I'm going to say remove bottom nav links which are broken. So remember that comment because we're going to come back and take a look at that in depth later on. So I'm now checking that into Team Foundation Server. Let's assume that I went through the process of then deploying this change out to my website. Well, okay, great, marketing team's happy, but what's going to happen in a week when the development team that's working against the iteration 2 branch says, okay, we're done with our changes, we're going to push those up to production? Well, because this change hasn't been made in the branch of code that they're working on, of course, that change is going to go back up to the website, those links are still going to be broken, and marketing's going to call us over the weekend and yell at us again. So I don't want this to happen, so what I'll do instead is I'll actually take this change and say we're going to merge that back into the branch that the developers are currently working on right now. And I happen to know that the developers are currently working on this branch called iteration 2. But how do I actually go through the process of navigating my branch hierarchy and understanding how to get that change from the production branch into iteration 2? Well, in the past, you would have really had to understand intimate details about the branching structure to know where to get started. In 2010, what we've done is we've introduced, first of all, the ability to create this hierarchy visualization on the fly. So here I see that production one is a child of Maine. Well, that's the first step. We understand who my direct parent is, but wouldn't it be nice to understand how to get to iteration two? So we'll take a look at the full hierarchy, and we can see that basically what we have here is that iteration one, iteration two, and production one, they all go through this integration branch. So this isn't a lecture on branching and merging, but this is basically a very simple branching scenario. If I want to move changes from one branch, I have to go through main in order to get to the other branch. So, okay, well, that's great, but let's actually figure out how to move that change. Well, what I can do is I can take a look at history for production one, and you can see that I've removed the bottom nav links, which are broken. I can now track this change set. It asks me which branches I'm interested in tracking. Well, iteration one finished a month ago, but iteration two is the one that I need to move this into. And now we'll visualize this. And of course, remember, green is good, so we know that the change has been made in production one, and everything else is currently not lit up, so we know that this change hasn't been moved into the other branches. So I'll take this branch, I'll drag and drop it onto main. It automatically populates the target. Next, 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 finish. It's now going to pin those changes into my workspace. Now I'm going to make a slightly different comment here, which is to say, taking some fast-tracked changes from production. Notice I'm not giving any detail about what changes actually got moved over, and we'll show you why that's important later. So here now we have a new change set. Change set 69 has been merged into main. Let's do the same thing, get that over to iteration 2, finish that. And then I'm even less specific, took some stuff from main. Okay, I'm getting sloppy at this point because I want to prove a point. We'll rerun that visualization. And great, so now everything's been moved over. Green is good. The developers have the new changes. Life is good, right? We can even take a look at this from a timeline tracking perspective and see a different view. So you can see exactly how these changes were introduced. You can see 68 was introduced first, and then it was moved into main, and then it was moved into iteration 2. This is a nice view if you have to answer a question like, well, does the website currently have this bug fix? Well, I don't know. The last time we pushed to production was on Friday. And so we know we introduced the change in one branch on Wednesday. Well, did it actually make it out to the production branch in time for us to push it out to the website? You know, any number of questions you might want to answer by taking a look at the timeline view. But let's now say that I'm a developer working over in iteration two, and I'm taking a look at what's happened since I, you know, got back from lunch, and I see, well, there's some changes. We took some stuff from main. Well, you know, that's not very helpful. Maybe this was actually part of a much bigger change set where we brought over a lot of work, and you know, that's not really telling me what we actually took over from main. We've lost the whole origin of intent, if you will, in this whole process. And so if we open up, took some stuff from main, you'll see that we made a change to template.master. Well, okay, that's starting to narrow it down. That's starting to help me understand what's going on. So let's go take a look at template.master in iteration 2. And there's template.master. But I don't really know what changed looking at this. You know, I don't look at this file every single day. Let's take advantage of a feature called annotate. Now, this is actually a feature that existed in 2008, but what I'm about to show you is something new that we've changed. What we have, this is in other source control solutions, they call it blame, because what you can see is who is the last person to change the last line of code. So you can see that for this line of code, the last person to change it was Abu, changed it as part of change set number 56. So now if that's ending up causing a problem, then we go blame Abu. Well, we call it annotate because we don't want to blame Abu. But if we take a look down here, you can see, okay, well, the last change actually happened on March 31st. And if I open this up, we can now see that we're not just showing you that this change was carried over from main, but we're actually telling you the original reason that this change was made. So we've made a lot of changes to enable this within TFS 2010, but you don't have to worry about the under-the-covers changes. Basically, all you have to do is take a look at the annotate view, and then we'll show you all the way back to the origin why that change was made. And so that's just an important way of lighting up that information and making it available to the rest of the team. Okay, let's see when I... Oh, so let's talk about builds. So I've mentioned builds a few times. In 2008, we made a lot of changes to the build engine, and in 2010, we've made even more changes. So if I look at Team Explorer over here, we can see that there's a builds node. And this build node has this existing build definition that I created earlier. I'll show you how I create that. So the build definition, first of all, allows me to decide how often I'm going to build or what the trigger is for building the software. Manual, self-explanatory. Continuous integration means every time someone makes a change, I want to actually build the software and make sure, number one, that it compiles, and number two, maybe I want to run a series of build verification tests. And so that's a great best practice that everyone should be doing, because that means if someone checks in a change and maybe they compiled it on their 32-bit machine, but it doesn't actually compile on both 32-bit and 64-bit, then that can cause a problem for you that we want to surface. Or maybe you forgot to check in a file, and so one of the unit tests is failing. Everything compiles fine, but you forgot to check in a file. Well, continuous integration can help surface those. Now, the problem with that is continuous integration only tells you, you just broke the build. And so, you know, how many people go to lunch and they checked in some changes and they come back, you know, an hour or two later and they find that their team is just really furious at them and makes them put money into the beer jar because they broke the build and now all their coworkers are, you know, having to fix the build. I'm sure no one in this room breaks the build ever, but, you know, your colleagues, I'm sure you have people that come to mind as I start telling this story, right? And so we have this problem at Microsoft too, especially with very large teams. Even if you have a room full of very, very bright developers and you have 30 people working on an individual team, and every one of those people only breaks the build once a month, which is pretty good, I think. That means that every single day, your build's going to be broken. You're going to be losing productivity fixing the build, and also as people start to check out changes, they may be checking out changes which are broken, and now even though you fixed the build server, you now have to go back to those people and say, hey, you know those changes you just got? You actually need to go back and get new changes and figure out how to redo your work, and you know, it's a big mess. And so years ago, we solved this problem within Microsoft by implementing a system called Gauntlet. And Gauntlet, as the name implies, means that your code has to go through a series of checks before it even gets committed into source control. And so maybe we want to make sure that it compiles and passes a series of quick unit tests to verify that the code is compliant and making sure that it's, you know, meeting up to our quality standards before we even check that into Team Foundation Server. And so we've implemented that feature in 2010 as just a single radio button. So if you want to take advantage of Gauntlet builds or what we're calling gated check-ins in 2010, all you have to do is enable this box to say, I want this to be a gated check-in. And what that does is it takes your changes and it first shelves them. If you're familiar with TFS, we have the idea of a shelf set, which is not within version control, but it's stored on the server so that it won't be lost. And so it shelves those changes. Then it builds your changes, and then if they pass, great, everything gets committed, and if they don't pass, then it kicks it back to the developer and it says, hey, you need to actually fix this. So with gated check-ins, it's possible to make sure that no one ever breaks the build again. Pretty cool. The other thing you can do, as I mentioned earlier, is you can take those layer diagrams and you can wire up the layer diagrams into your build definitions as well. So you can take all that architectural integrity and make sure that people can't violate the architectural integrity moving forward as well. So let's show you what one of these builds looks like. If I save this and let's say I make a change back to template.master again. Let's just go ahead and uncomment this, maybe. Save that change. Take this pending change. Let's try to break the build. And we'll check that in. Now, instead of actually checking it in, it's going to give me this dialog. And this dialog basically tells me, hey, before we check your changes into TFS, we're going to go ahead and build them and make sure that everybody's happy. Now, you may be wondering, well, hey, you know, I'm a lead developer and I'm pretty sure I know my stuff, or maybe, you know, all I did was make some change to some HTML. This isn't going to break the build. Let me just check the code in. And if you give someone privileges to do that, then they can actually check this lower checkbox, which bypasses the validation. So we give you that option, but you may want to keep the rest of your team members or some junior developers from actually checking in code which breaks the build. So at this point, I'll go ahead and build these changes. That's going to kick off a build. One of the things we've done in 2010 is we've greatly improved the build status. So if you take a look, you can actually see step by step what's going on with this build. It'll start to populate here in a second. We also do things like allow you to customize this build using Windows Workflow. So if I open this up in the Workflow Designer, I can actually do things like add a parallel work stream that says, you know, while you're building a 32-bit version of this, go ahead and build a 64-bit version as well. Maybe build both debug and retail. You can spread that out across multiple machines within your build farm. We have build agents you can install. So if you one of the cool things I thought would be nice is, let's say that you want to turn all of your developer workstations into build workstations, all you have to do is install a build agent, and then the Team Foundation Server Central Build Controller will then farm that build out to multiple machines as well. So you can make sure you have many more builds, like if you're doing continuous integration, or you can also just improve the speed of your builds by parallelizing that work stream across multiple computers. So you can see this is going to start populating here. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and stop for questions. And at a certain point, this will pop up and show us whether or not our change has passed or failed. But we have about 10 minutes if anyone has any questions. Otherwise, I will stick around and hope to see some of you in my talk tomorrow. So shout out if you do have questions. Yes. Are there reports that go across projects? So that's a great question. You can create reports that go across projects. None of the reports that we have within what I showed you do go across projects. So I'm not aware of any that report across project out of the box. But yes, you can. The caveat is you have to be doing it within one team project collection. So if you have one team project collection, you might want to use that for all of the projects related to your accounting applications, right? You might have multiple solutions and projects that run within there. But if you want to be able to report across multiple projects, then a best practice is to make sure those are all grouped under one team project collection. In the future, one of the things we want to do is we want to start lighting up dashboards that can allow you at maybe a CIO level to say, okay, how's this project doing versus this project, and start to light up some of that information as well. But right now, we're focused on an individual project, and we've got room to grow. Anything else? Please shout out if I can't see everybody. Ah, there. Yes. Great question. So build is workflow based now. What does that mean for your existing team build definitions, which are based on MS build? And so not a problem. We've addressed that here. If I create a new build definition, one of the things you can do is come down to the process tab. And we ship a template, which is an upgrade template for 2005 and 2008 projects. So if you have existing build definitions that you want to move over, then you can use this upgrade template, or you can just create a brand new one, just depending on how much you've invested in that. So yeah, great question. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I think this is still running here. So at some point, we'll get a pop-up. Oh, let's take a look at the build here. Yeah, it's still running some of the tests related to this build, so you can take my word for it. Eventually, we do pop up and say whether or not the build passed or failed. So I'll stick around if anyone else has any questions. Otherwise, if you're interested in software testing, I hope to see some of you in my talk tomorrow. One more question?
There's one up here.
Yes, thank you.
Is it possible to limit gated check-ins to a directory within a team project?
Is it possible to limit gated check-ins to a directory within a team project? And yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Thank you very much. I'll see some of you tomorrow.